Welcome to this month's seminar on scaling up input technology and input access, clues from Zambia. Welcome to those of us in the room. Now please take a moment, silence your phones if you haven't already. And welcome to those of us joining over the webinar from around the world. Last I knew, the prize for furthest away was Nepal, so kudos to you for staying up late. So I'm Kristen Oplanik from USAID's Bureau for Economic Growth, Education, and Environment. And this is a special joint event. It is an Ag Sector Council and a Microlink seminar. So we are doubly glad to have you with us. Today we will explore two new studies on Zambia that review different aspects of the agricultural input supply market evolution. While we all are well aware of donor obsession with scale, within the context of markets, it really is about reaching a point of sustainable viability, not necessarily number volume. So why does this matter? Over the course of the discussion, we aim to discover just what factors did allow for inputs to scale in Zambia and what that might mean for other markets that we work in. These cases were commissioned from different perspectives, and we got lucky that they complement so nicely. In a moment, Mark will give us a bit of context on the drought-tolerant maize study. But the Scaling Impact Zambia Profit case study is the first study reviewing the ex post status of business models initially supported by donors' market facilitation projects. The second is currently in progress in Cambodia. Those of you familiar with the MSME project. This study examines the extent to which input suppliers continue to serve the smallholder farmer market segment. And I'll turn it over to Mark to continue our introduction.
Well, good morning. Thank you for coming, and hello to all you people online. And we have a couple special guests here today. I want to introduce. One is Dr. Richard Cole, who is leading our series of case studies that we're just undertaking now in looking at examples of successful scaling. Dr. Cole has been supportive, helpful to USAID as we have really started to focus on, okay, how do we get some of the technologies that we have invested a lot of our research dollars in to scale? What kind of systems can we put in place? What could be some of the strategies? So he has been helping us a great deal work through some of these issues. And then we've also got Mr. Dan White, who is working as a technical director for ACDI VOCA. He's working on LEO-related activities and has also looked at issues of scaling some technologies, including in Zambia. I think this is a great opportunity for Microlink and the Ag Sector Council to start doing more together. I think we have a lot of shared relevant research, and it's and hopefully we can maximize our learning by joining together in some of our sessions. I want to just frame the study a little. So we're interested in monetizing our research. Probably in Feed the Future, we've put close to $1 billion of research and development money into developing new technologies and innovations. How do we get those technologies out to smallholder farmers? That's part of what we're trying to understand with through the case studies that we're now doing. And I wanted to just put this up here because I think it just gives an idea of some of the challenges that we have in trying to get technologies to scale. So if you look at this, this is probably a matrix a lot of you have seen before. It's very commonly used with infrastructure type of projects where you've got your public goods, your private goods. You've got supply pushing. Here's demand pull. The thing is a lot of the research that we've invested in is in crops, say, like millet and sorghum that are down here, and there's not really a private commercial option for getting those out to small holders through public funding. It will take public funding. We did some analysis on sorghum and milk, on sorghum in Ethiopia, for instance, and found that the getting the early generation seeds for sorghum had a minus 1,200% internal rate of return. There's not any private companies that are going to be interested in financing that type of scaling of a small grain crop. On the other hand, something like hybrid maize should be totally commercially viable. And so some of the what we want to understand through our case studies in particular is how this works, or how we can have public-private partnerships that can shift some of the other crops that we're looking at from more from what we would call a common good, so some of the open pollinated varieties of crops that we see, over to more the private good quadrant. I don't want to dwell on this. I just want to put this up there because it does sort of frame the way we're picking some of the cases that we're looking at. So with that, I'm going to leave it. I'm going to turn it over to Richard Cole. If anyone wants to revisit this later during Q&A, we can do that. But Richard, the floor is now yours.
Thanks. Well, it's great to be here, and I just want to expand a little bit on what Mark said about the studies that we're doing. We're going to be doing 5 country case studies, of which actually the Zambian maize case is the first. And what we're trying to understand, as Mark said, is what were the drivers and spaces that allowed for scaling up to occur successfully, and we are focusing specifically on cases where the commercial sector played an important role in scaling. Because as Mark said, USAID and Feed the Future put quite a bit of money into innovations, and we all know that there are limits about the amount of money that donors. The old school model of, well, we put out an RFP or an RFA for, you know, $50 million for 5 years, and you do 100,000 farmers. Well, how do we scale that up? Well, supposedly we do another 5 years and another $50 million and another 100,000 farmers. We're just never going to get to scale that way, even in the zones of influence. And so the question we were really trying to ask is there a way, whether USAID or other donors for that matter, can create a foundation, a critical mass, a tipping point, all of the above, that allows the types of innovations that USAID has been funding and supporting to go to scale? And so we were looking for cases where that had more or less happened to some degree or another, and what could we learn from them? And maize, hybrid maize in Zambia was one of them. I want to say that we try to focus basically on 3 or 4 factors. First of all, was there some characteristic of the innovation itself that allowed for scaling to happen? Secondly, was there some characteristic of the market system or the enabling environment? And I use both those words because I don't want you to think it's only the private sector structure or only the political, regulatory, legal, but both, including potentially government policy. And last but not least, was there some agent or driver or leader that actually proactively pushed a scaling strategy? And if they did, what were the activities they did that were successful? And what can we learn from that? Okay? So I'm not going to read these slides. I get the impression that most people here are literate. At least that's my presumption. If you're not one of those, my apologies. Okay? But let me just give a little bit of background, because actually this is important. Maize, historically, and particularly in the last 20 years, is only grown by small farmers in Zambia. And that has a lot to do with actually some distortions that the government has introduced in the market that basically makes it unprofitable for large farmers to do so. And we could talk about some of that a bit later. One of the points I want to highlight is the history is actually really important in this case. And we've already done a couple other cases where that's showing the case. And there are two things that are very important. I have to say, confess that my PhD is in economic history, so perhaps that's my bias. But first of all, in the case is that basically a lot of African countries had state-dominated, state-funded, state-implemented, quasi-socialist or statist, I don't care what label you want to call it, but heavy government intervention up through the early 90s. And a lot of whatever happened in agriculture, for good or bad, up until that point, was state-driven. In the case of Zambia, that's actually quite relevant, because hybrid maize did go to scale in Zambia in the 1980s, almost exclusively driven by government working in partnership with some of the donors, brought in people from Yugoslavia or the ex-Yugoslavia, who created a breeding program, and then they pushed through the government extension system, and a very large number of farmers, I think it was 60, 70, 80%, were using hybrid maize. Zambia, as some of you probably remember, was a highly indebted country, and in the 1990s had the usual structural adjustment plan with the World Bank and the IMF, and that entire state apparatus was completely dissembled. All the subsidies, all the intervention, a lot of the extension system, the state marketing board, the whole shebang. And as a consequence of that, the adoption of hybrid maize dropped precipitously, probably to less than half of what it had been. And that state of affairs continued through the 1990s. Now, one of the other consequences, though, of structural adjustment was a dramatic liberalization of access to foreign exchange, or the ability of multinationals to come in to invest, free foreign exchange rates. They could take money out of the country, very liberal, hands-off market environment. And the reason that's particularly relevant in this case is because what happened, along with some other historical reasons, which I'll mention briefly, is that Zambia became the center for maize seed production for Southern Africa. Okay, one factor was the climate was perfect, and the location was ideal. It's sort of centrally located in Southern Africa. Second, for better or worse, a lot of maize seed had traditionally been produced in Zimbabwe, and as things started to go downhill with Mugabe, particularly a lot of white farmers who had been traditionally the big maize producers and maize seed producers fled. And so actually when you go to Zambia, a lot of the multipliers are actually ex-Zimbabwean farmers who now live in Zambia. And along with that, all the big guys moved in, DuPont, Monsanto, et cetera, et cetera. They did not move into Zambia to produce maize seed for Zambia. And in fact, for many years, they didn't really sell much maize seed in Zambia. They were exporting to South Africa, Zimbabwe, and all the countries in the region, I think as far up as even Kenya, Tanzania, East Africa. Well, it's not that far. There's borders there. Okay? So that's important to know. Okay? And what I want you to particularly think about is that then what happened is in the early 2000s and the mid-2000s, Zambia has traditionally not been food secure in maize. It has traditionally been a large net maize importer. And there were droughts and other food adverse weather conditions in the 2000s, particularly, I think it was 2000, 2001. I'm sure somebody's going to correct me on the years. In 2005, 2006, which spurred the government to take action. Initially, the action was, we want to become food secure and food independent, but there wasn't any there. They weren't actively pushing it, though they did start to reintroduce two key programs, which Dan and I will be talking about quite a bit today, one called FISP and the other called FRA. And FISP is basically an input supply program, which allowed farmers to get access to a minimal amount, basically enough for a hectare or a half a hectare, depending on the intensity of usage, of fertilizer and what ended up being hybrid maize seed. And FRA was a buying program where the government started to buy, especially in rural areas, maize output from farmers at guaranteed prices. Okay? After the 2005-06 crisis, both of those programs escalated dramatically and steadily over the ensuing years. Okay? And so what happened was there sort of became a virtuous circle in which is the government started pushing it. Farmers, many of whom were old enough to remember that they had been using hybrid maize 10, 15, 20 years ago, so this wasn't really a new idea for them, started to adopt it, and the seed company said, oh, there's a little bit of a domestic market, so let's start marketing domestically. The more they marketed domestically, the more farmers knew about this hybrid maize and were getting good results. And this was particularly supported also by CIMMYT, which was working with many of the large seed companies, again, not targeting the Zambian market so much as helping them with germplasm, technical assistance, and other things to improve the quality of their maize seeds. And at this time in particular, USAID and the Gates Foundation and several others were also supporting drought-tolerant maize for Africa. And this was an important part of the activities that CIMMYT was doing, particularly on the research side, both working with some of the large companies to develop their own brands and also making available CIMMYT-developed varieties of DTMA. Okay? So what you have then that happens, and I'm going to skip some of these because I only have 15 minutes, is you end up with a threefold, actually it's easier to see this graphically. So this is roughly about 2005 or 6, okay, and right here, and about 2007 or 8, you can see that this really takes off, okay? And what you'll notice is several factors happening at the same time. You do get some bump in yields, but if you look at the scale, the bump in yields is not that big. It's kind of hard to make sense of this because the numbers bounce around, and if you think about that, that's actually quite significant. The reason the numbers bounce around is that maize production in Zambia is entirely rain-fed. And so you can have the best, well, that's not true. We'll come back to that in a minute. But improved hybrid maize seed only moderates to some extent your ability to balance off when you have bad or good seasons. But if you kind of average this out, you get about a 20 or 30% bump in productivity, which isn't bad. The big change you get is look what's happening in this, the amount of land being produced with maize. Okay, it goes from about 150,000 to 350,000, and it's pretty stable, and when last seen was still headed north. Okay, the other interesting thing that's happening is more and more maize is being sold. And I don't have the table up here, but by the time we get around here, which is 2010, 11, 12, there's such a boom in maize production, particularly because of the increase in land being planted, that actually Zambia becomes a net maize exporter. The reason I'm kind of rolling my eyes about a net maize exporter is it's a little bit more complicated than that, which is that this whole thing is largely, well, I don't know about driven, it's significantly influenced by the FRA buying program. By the time we're over here in 2010, 11, 12, 13, FRA starts to buy 50, 60, 70, 80% of the maize that's being sold, particularly in rural areas. Okay? So if you think about it, you have guaranteed inputs at a heavily subsidized price, okay, but not for large-scale production, only for about a hectare. If you want to produce more than a hectare, you have to buy on your own, and a guaranteed market from the government that will buy. Okay? And the combination of those things is farmers started planting more and more maize. The government started buying more and more maize. And all of a sudden, the question was, well, what are we going to do with all this maize? We have more than we need. And they started dumping it, actually, in South Africa, Zimbabwe, and others at substantial losses. So technically, I guess you could call them an exporter. But I just want to put a big asterisk there that this was not an export at profit, even though there is some evidence that actually Zambia does produce, could compete if they didn't screw up their pricing and distortions and all the other things. We could talk about that. So how much time have I got? Five. That's what I thought. Good. Okay. So what did we learn about this, about scaling? First of all, donors did play an important role in scaling up by particularly CIMMYT's work and working with the large companies and also to a lesser extent, and I want to emphasize this because Mark mentioned it in his introduction, a lot of the CIMMYT-released varieties were OPVs, or open pollinated varieties. The farmers don't want them. Okay, did you hear me? The farmers do not want OPVs. They were often given away or introduced in NGO projects or donor-funded projects, and the farmers highly prefer the hybrids, despite the fact that they do have to buy them every year, though many farmers told me that, in fact, if they have a bad year and they can't afford to buy ones, they just use them for a second year, and they don't experience that big a drop-off, at least the second year, in productivity. But that was important. Second, I think we have to remember that actually hybrid maize is a pretty good thing to adopt in the sense that it's not that complicated. They didn't have to change their practices. Again, this is different in Zambia. In many countries where they grow traditional staples like maize and rice, they don't use fertilizer and things like that. They were already doing that here, okay, because of the history, all right? So the advantage of maize, it was basically plug and play. Take out the old seed, put in the new seed, okay? You could do it at very low entry costs. In other words, unlike, for example, starting with a drip irrigation system, well, you can have small drip, but even so, the smallest drips I've seen are several hundred dollars, and usually if you're going to do a market gardens, talking $500, $700, $1,000, $2,000. You can buy 200 grams of hybrid maize seed if you want in Zambia. The initial, and as I told you, it's also that quantity is subsidized by the government. So the initial investment is very small. The technology is very simple. There's not a whole package of good agricultural practices that some team of agronomists have to come and sit and hold your hand for 3 years to get a bump in the productivity. Now, you may have noticed that the bump in the productivity we only got was about 20-30%. Probably, if there had been somebody holding their hand, they might have gotten significantly more. And in fact, there is now a move in Zambia with some USAID and other funded projects to introduce conservation agriculture, because particularly southern Zambia is very prone to climate change, and they're having more and more droughts and adverse weather. Actually, that was very interesting. We wanted to see whether the adoption of maize was driven by adverse weather, and we had a conflict, because when we talked to the farmers, they said, absolutely. Our rains are delayed a month or two. When they come, we have 2, 3, 4 inches of rain in like 5 days. Then we don't have any rain for 3 weeks, and then we have more rain, and then we don't have rain for the rest of the season. So we plant late, our crops are wiped out by floods, we replant, and then we don't have enough rain to get that. So we are, in fact, by the way, in reaction, seeing a substantial shift to short maturity varieties. However, the flip side of that was when we tried to verify that statistically, we looked at annual rainfall measures, and they hadn't changed. And so what's interesting about this is it's not the amount of rainfall, it's the variability about when it comes, how often it comes, et cetera, et cetera. I want to emphasize, which I mentioned before, the key factor that drove this was the existence of the large number of multinational seed companies that were already producing hybrid maize. And for this was like a no-brainer. In other words, don't have to do anything different. We've already got these varieties, and they now have aggressively selling. There's over I think it's about 10 or 15 companies now in the country, including several domestic companies have started to come in and are producing. And I want to emphasize the dog that didn't bark. As Mark can tell you, if you buy him a beer, he will cry into his beer or USAID's beer. One of the problems often in introducing new seed varieties is the existence of very strong state monopolies or parastatals that often control, if not the breeder seed and the foundation seed, the multiplication, and often are a very strong vested interest that are very resistant to the private sector coming in. The fact is that in Zambia, Zamseed was privatized in the mid-1990s, and so therefore all the other seed companies were not competing with this big elephant that had state political support, etc. Okay? Yes, I've got one more slide. Okay? So some of the other lessons, I think, for USAID in terms of thinking about scaling and other donors is one of the questions that we went in to ask was, as I mentioned, USAID and other donors were supporting both germplasm, better seeds in general, and particularly drought tolerant, and what made sense? What we ended up seeing is that today, drought tolerant maize still has a smaller share of the market. It's only about 10 or 15%, but it's starting to take off. And I think you could put the two and two together. The reason it's starting to take off is because they're now, I should have mentioned that one of the things that I think drove successful adoption, if we go back to this slide, here is you see the huge bump here, this sort of acceleration, and you see this huge bump here. These were really good years in terms of weather. Okay, so they got very high yields those years. So just as FRA and FISP are sort of starting to push it, the seed companies are jumping on the bandwagon and saying, hey, we can make a lot of money here. They get all this hybrid, not all, but a significant amount of hybrid maize seed out there, and the farmers have incredible years. They have huge surpluses, which they can make really good money. They say, whoa, I can't tell you how many farmers, when I said, well, why do you grow hybrid maize? And they all kind of looked at me, because you'd be an idiot not to. Okay, I mean, literally that was the response, and that response was based on this experience, even though subsequently, look what's happened to yield, primarily because of bad weather. So they're starting, now that this is happening, to shift towards drought-tolerant varieties and short-maturing varieties in response. And so back to my conclusions, it may make sense to try to get farmers to adopt some generic version of an innovation before we go with the fancy stuff, in this case, drought-tolerant maize. Secondly, I think we'll talk about this more, but a bit controversial. One of the things we're seeing, at least in Africa, is even though it's not the flavor of the month for governments to intervene in the markets to subsidize either inputs or to buy at outputs, that clearly did play a role in the situation, an important role in the situation in Zambia, like it or not. And I think I'll be provocative here. One might like to think, whether it's USAID, the World Bank, or others, is there a role in guaranteeing access both to inputs and some kind of market support on the output side for a few years so that to minimize the risk for farmers of adopting a new technology? Now, we all know the dangers of that, and the dangers of that being once you create that constituency and politically, all the incentives for the government are to not only do more of it, but to keep doing it. And in fact, that has happened here. And in fact, now the maize subsidy budget, both on the input side and the output side, is eating something like 95% of the Ministry of Agriculture's budget. And there are huge complaints from all the rest of the sector that they get no support. And it's a big problem. And I think Dan will talk about some of the things they're trying to do on that. And the last thing I just want to say is that a key thing that we have been looking at is why do all the actors play ball? And in this case, you can see that there were incentives for the private sector. They could make money. There was a pre-existing network of agri-dealers, which often doesn't exist. I should have mentioned that. And that was steadily expanded, though, as Dan will mention, and one of the things is that adoption appears to have largely started and been closer to major roads. And as you get further and further away from the agri-dealers and the roads, the rates of adoption have been much lower. We estimate an average of about 60, 65, 70%. Close to the roads, it's almost 100%. As you get 30, 50, 100 kilometers in, you're starting to see 60, 50, 40%. And because this was largely private sector driven, even though FRA and FISP do make an effort to extend out there, we haven't seen... Small farmers have adopted everywhere, but not so much small farmers in more remote, less accessible rural areas. And so, again, I think we could highlight that as an area where donor intervention can possibly help expand and extend the last mile. But my point being that we have the incentives aligned, the government was supportive, the donors were supportive, the private sector had an interest, and this made sense financially for the farmers. And when I say financially, the last thing I'm going to say is that there's a tendency when we scale up, particularly in agriculture, to look at crop budgets. And when we run the numbers, you know, price of the inputs, price of the outputs, blah, 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 do they make money? We are finding that that may be relevant, and it certainly is relevant, because if it's a negative number, it never happens. But risk is more important than return. Let me say that again. Risk is more important than return. And in this case, the fact that FISP was minimizing risk on the input side by subsidizing the inputs and zeroing out the risk on the output side. Basically, as I said, FRA is now, depending upon the year, buying 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% of the output and 100% of the output for farmers in more rural, remote areas has, I think, been a major driver. Again, do we want that? It's also created significant distortions in the market, not just on the government budget, but I don't have time to talk about that. It's created real problems in the processing sector. It's driven large farmers out of maize. But it has minimized risk and allowed for adoption. And so choose your poison. So I'll stop there, and we can talk about this more later. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone, for coming. Thanks, Richard, for an interesting first presentation. Hard to follow. So for those of you that don't know me, my name is Dan White. I'm a technical director for agriculture at ACD Iboca. And over the past 2 years, I've been co-leading the scaling research stream under the LEO project, where we've been trying to identify cases of programs around the world that seem like they have managed to sustainably increase smallholder adoption of improved inputs and practices at something approximating scale, at least scale as defined within the parameters of donor projects, which is a slightly different order of magnitude than what Richard's been looking at. So today I'm going to talk about one of these case studies, and specifically looking at the original Zambia Profit Program from a slightly different perspective than Richard has been talking about it, so I think it will be interesting to follow up in our conversations and trying to see where these might intersect. But this is really going to be looking at, you know, what did that project do right, and what can we learn from it moving forward in terms of lessons to apply to other programs. So for those of you that might not be familiar with the project, the PROFIT program was implemented from 2005 to 2010, so you can keep that in mind relative to the time series scales that Richard had put up there, by NCBA CLUSA for the Zambian mission. And it was focused on a number of different value chains, but ended up doing some really interesting work on expanding input supply access for smallholders. So our case study was going back last year and trying to figure out 5 years later what of those systemic shifts within the input supply sector seem like they've actually endured and how they evolved over time after the project had left. So a quick note on methodology. There were several months of desk research looking at the past project reports, some of the other evaluation material. There's a wealth of existing case studies and other work on the Microlinx website, which I would highly recommend anyone going back and looking at, which were a very good starting point. That really did, I think, particularly compared to other projects at that same time, Prophet was notable for how methodically put its theories of change were and how articulated from the very beginning of the project both the design but also the measurement approach was going to be. So it was a really interesting case to go back to 10 years later because you already have all of that articulated approach. Whereas with most programs, you go back, if you can't talk to the staff that worked on it, a lot of that initial thinking around the design gets lost and it's hard to interpret what they actually did. So last May and June, we followed up that desk research with a 4 to 6 week field assignment. I led it with Paul Kalu and Kevin Lukuta, who were two Lusaka-based consultants that helped doing particularly the heavy lifting on interviewing some of the in-customer farmers. We interviewed 7 input suppliers who had been partners with the Prophet Project in implementing this initial model, 16 of their former and current agents, and about 50 of their current smallholder farmer customers in Southern Province. So before I get into the specific findings, there are two sort of higher level takeaways that I really want to emphasize for anyone that's looking for lessons to apply to their own project design or implementation. First, I think there's a lot of discussion, and particularly in some of the existing literature and in people I've talked to about, okay, what was it about the Prophet model that has really worked? And this is something I talked about with Mike Field and the point he made that I think is really, really key, which is that any of these models that we found that have been really successful, their success has been so context dependent that I think it's kind of the wrong question to say what are the successful models in terms of intervening in a value chain that are going to make systemic changes. It's really about what were the questions that that project asked that led to the development of that model in response to that specific situation. And the Prophet Project stood out particularly at the time because of how multidisciplinary and how synthetic their design and analysis was. So they were not just looking at the agronomics or the economics from a transaction perspective, but they were looking at how those overlaid with the social networks. So when we talk about moving from a value chain framework to a market systems framework, this is really what we're talking about. It's trying to figure out these complex histories and how they interact with the economy, with economics and agronomics at the same time. So I think that's really what I would say is a universal best practice, is making sure you're asking questions across all of these different layers. At the same time, and this also echoes a lot of what Richard said, so I won't dwell too much on it, you really have to pay attention to these macro level trends. It's very easy when you start implementing a project and you've got your deliverables and you're going to hire staff and do these other things, you just drill right down into trying to figure out what you're going to train farmers to do. But if you don't take the time to figure out what's going on in the overarching economy, not just an initial snapshot at project design or at the value chain phase, but really take a look at what the enduring trends are going to be, looking at what's happening in relevant other sectors of the economy, looking at what's happening to other subsectors within agriculture, figuring out what's happening to things like the currency. I mean, this is a huge issue right now across most of Southern Africa where, synthetic inputs that are primarily imported are suddenly, overnight, over the past 12 months or so, no longer financially viable for smallholder farmers because their prices have gone up 80 or 90%. If you're not paying attention to these things, you can design something up front that works very well, but you're almost certainly going to be overwhelmed by these larger effects that are operating on orders of magnitude far beyond anything any project could ever function with. So in my mind, it's kind of, we tend to design these projects like we're hiking, right? Where you go in and you say, okay, you've got a static topography and you're moving from point A to point B, and as long as you keep up a steady pace, you'll get there. So you've got farmers that are growing 1.8 tons of maize per hectare, and 5 years from now they're going to be growing 2.8. But it's not really like that. It's more like we're surfing, right? Where if you're a good surfer, you might have your technique and know how much effort it's going to take, but you really need to be able to read the riptide, you need to be able to read the swells and the currents and understand all of these much larger forces that are going on around you. And if you do that right, you're going to be able to go a lot further than if you're just going to be paddling to shore. But if you do it wrong, you're not going to go anywhere. So I think it's really important to keep track of those things. I'm not a surfer, though, so I apologize. I've mangled the sport for my own. So a little bit on the Prophet Project. At the time, Prophet was looking at a couple of different value chains, and Mike Field was one of the original architects of this entire approach. And so the way he described their design was they'd been looking at a few different things and realized fairly quickly that the input supply sector, and particularly this mismatch between the existing network of commercial agro dealers and their smallholder customers, potential smallholder customers, was a real problem point in terms of the fact that a lot of smallholders were not actually buying commercial improved inputs, even though the economics were there to make it work, and there was some sort of distribution system. So he went out and their team looked at a wide range of things, and they found that there was this particular negative feedback loop that was leading to that market failure. So on the one hand, you had input suppliers and the agri-dealer networks, which were based a lot on these personal relationships, similar to the historical continuities that Richard talked about. These are largely large-scale commercial farmers that are mostly white, with input suppliers who are also mostly white, coming from the same social networks, and a lot of their sales were driven by these personal relationships. So you had a very small number of customers who were all making very large volume purchases, which is what drove most of the input supply sector. So their entire marketing and sales strategy was very similar to their social strategy, in a sense. At the same time, you had smallholders at the village level, and particularly in these further afield areas, that are generally very distrustful of outsider companies. So even if there was an input supplier that was thinking about breaking into the smallholder market, they couldn't make any inroads because they didn't have any of those social connections that they needed. So the Profit Project really focused on shifting input suppliers, on trying to develop a model that did two things. That would, on the one hand, shift input suppliers to what Mike Field called a mass market perspective. So getting them to start thinking about what it would take to sell to a large number of customers, relatively small volumes that are all strangers and part of totally alien social frameworks to the suppliers. And at the same time, figure out a way to get input suppliers to leverage the social networks at the village level to build trust. So Profit deployed a couple of different models, but largely ended up settling on a few different variations with different partners on a hub and spoke agent model. Which there's a lot of really great stuff on the Microlinks website, including a case study that Jennifer Sebstadt did, another case study done under AMAP by Cardno and Joe Dougherty, which I recommend looking up. So I won't spend too much time talking about the specific dynamics of the model, but briefly, the way they would work was the input supplier and the village leadership would come together, and they would talk about their various criteria for what one of these agents would look like. They'd select somebody from the community. That person would get trained up in marketing and a little bit of extension around whatever seed that company, this was mostly for seed, wanted to sell. And then that agent would work on promoting the seed to his or her neighbors, to bulking their orders, and to working out the logistics for the supply to the village once they got to a minimum threshold of tonnage. They would make anywhere from 5 to 10% the value of the seed as a commission off of that. So they weren't holding stock, they were just making commission and coordinating the transportation. So by 2010, this model seemed like it had really taken off systemically. That AMAP paper I referenced had gone out and tried to look at what the estimated impact had been, found that there were new firms crowding in that the project hadn't even worked with. There were 4 million unique sales through these agent networks. An estimated 180,000 farmers were getting reached through these expanded systems. CLUSA estimates that their numbers are slightly higher even. They say it was closer to 500,000 by the end of the project that were actually getting reached through this. And so on a lot of different metrics, the growth trajectory was really on a path to reaching population level scale. So we went out, 5 years later and said, okay, did that really happen? Well, what's happened in the interim period? And does it seem like this increased input supplier focus on smallholder farmers was something that endured, and is it still going on? And I encourage anyone to read the paper, which is actually up on Microlinks now, if you want to get a bit more into some of the data. But for interest of time, I'm just going to give you the short spiel, which is that yes, they are. That the smallholder farmers are still a large and growing focus for the input supply sector. Most firms have expanded their rural catchment since 2005, moving into some of these areas that are further afield, and they continue to do so. Firms are providing an increasing variety of inputs tailored to smallholder farmer needs, so they're providing scaled down product sizing, they're providing streamlined embedded extension information on those products that are targeted towards low literacy farmers, and they are now specifically marketing towards the different agroecological zones. So they're marketing their short cycle maize in areas with less rainfall there, et cetera. Firms are also have taken this model in different directions. So everyone that I talked to was still actively thinking about how to crack the nut of this smallholder market. Some of them are continuing trying to push into greenfield markets so they can be the first company that's really getting out in some of these more obscure areas, while others have decided it really makes a lot more sense for them to intensify their marketing efforts in their existing catchment and try to outcompete their peers that way. As Richard mentioned, though, the Prophet Project in part got lucky because there were these other secular trends going on at the same time that had nothing to do with it that tended to increase both smallholder appetite for some of these improved inputs and also push the input supply sector to move out, to reach out to them. So there's the FRA and FISIP, which I won't talk any more about. But there was also this interesting thing that several input suppliers mentioned, which was that around the same time that you, in 2005, 2006, you had a crisis in a lot of the core commercial crops, including tobacco. So the commercial sector was starting to stagnate at that time and hasn't really recovered from that. And so their traditional sales market was starting to stagnate. And so at that same time, Prophet came along and was saying, hey, you're really interested in trying to crack this nut of smallholder farmers. At the margin, I think that pushed them, and they said it pushed them to probably take more risks than they might have had their existing market base been doing well. But even with all of these exogenous factors, a majority of the input suppliers that we talked to did say that Prophet played a really key role in terms of stimulating their increased focus on smallholders, specifically because Prophet insisted that it was these companies that managed the agent network, not Prophet. And there were two companies that I talked to who actually said the same thing, which is that in their initial negotiations with the Prophet program, they were pushing very hard for Prophet to be the ones who would go out and select the agents who would manage the logistics of the supply chain because they didn't really want to deal with the headache. But looking back on it now, they said that it was specifically that experience of having to go out, select staff in a way that they had never done before, in conjunction with the village leadership, to really try to actually go through the growing pains of understanding what had to change in their internal systems to make this work, to figure out what, in terms of increases in revenue, would be necessary to justify the additional costs in terms of logistics. It was that experience that they said really has endured in terms of allowing them to understand what it takes to get into this market and making sure that they were pushing through it. So I think that's definitely one of the key takeaways, is that even if up front it's going to be a lot easier for you to act in that facilitative role between the agent and the input supplier, trying to move as far away from the village as possible, keep those activities within the existing supply chain, it's going to have a lot more growing pains up front, but it can be a lot more durable. So the last two things that I'll say are in terms of learning for future projects. So this multidisciplinary analysis up front is key. This is what I was mentioning at the beginning, and I think this is really, you know, where the success came from. I mean, as far as I can tell, I'm sure there might be others, but this is the earliest example of this agent model that I've found within a donor context, a donor-funded program context. And I think that's mostly because they didn't go about it seeing if they could apply an existing model from somewhere else. I mean, because at this point, these agent models are pretty standard. Everyone says that they've got their own approach to it, and I think they're quickly becoming the sort of new demo plot in terms of a go-to approach to agricultural development. But this was pretty early, and I think it's because they didn't start with a model and see if it would fit. They started with the analysis. They started trying to look at the interplay between the economics and the social side, and then they backed out a logical model from that. And I think that's really the key. And then the last point that I'll make, because I think it's something that came up in talking to some of the input suppliers who had stopped, had abandoned the model, is that it's really important when you're working, particularly at this last mile level, where you're trying to get down to work with developing either a new agro dealer or an agent who needs to develop a business model, any kind of level where you're going to be dealing with relatively small number of customers buying relatively small volumes of things, you need to be open to the fact that regardless of what your project works on, if it's a maize and rice program or you're dealing with soy and tomatoes, you need to be open to working across anything and everything that agent could sell at the input supply level. So in order for you to sustainably increase access to that maize seed that you really want your farmers to buy, you're probably going to have to step back and look at some other higher margin products that agent could push out at the village level that are going to give them full calendar year coverage, right? Because when you're selling these staple food seeds, you're only going to be having a sales window of maybe eight weeks out of a year. And honestly, that seed's never going to give them enough margins to make it worth their time to continue with the program. So there was one of the input suppliers that was using this model with just tomato seed in areas where the tomato production was all rain-fed. So again, you only have sales for about 8 weeks out of the year. And most of these farmers that were growing the tomatoes were only growing those tomatoes in maybe 20 or 30% of their land. There was a whole other host of things that they were growing that they had to go somewhere else to buy their seed for. But it meant that in a village of maybe 300 people, this agent, even if he was selling that tomato seed to all of them, was only making about $80 off of that off of that. So this company had a problem where they came back to these agents. They said they had a decent first season, but they came back to them 12 months later, and none of them wanted to do it again because they hadn't continued that relationship, and it wasn't really worth their time for what they were able to offer. Now, if those agents had been set up to offer poultry vaccinations, to sell solar lamps, to sell anything and everything that might have a slightly higher margin that would give them a full 12 months of sales, I think the likelihood that that could continue would be really, would have been much higher. So, yeah, that's it.